Welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to exploring the universe of public domain media. My name is Christopher. The task I've set for this podcast is too big for just one person, so I've enlisted some help. With me today is a new voice to Orphaned Entertainment, a podcaster, podcast listeners of old that might have subscribed to Screen Geeks Radio will recognize the walking, talking IMDb, Barry Wurst. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. I am so thrilled that you could be with me today. My regular co-host, Lydia, was unable to attend this evening. So I'm really glad I asked you to join me, so I didn't have to try to reschedule things and whatnot.
Yes, we're going to handle this.
Yeah, we can do it. Well, right before I invited you to join us, I thought, I couldn't figure out why didn't I do this before? This was something I was like, you know, of anyone that I know that would truly enjoy some of these films and really be able to pull out some of the really finer points of this stuff is Barry. Why have I not thought of this before?
Well, thank you so much. I'm really honored. And I'll tell you what, I've not either seen this film before or even heard of it prior to you asking me. So this was a learning experience for me too.
Oh, fantastic. Good. Well, the film we'll be talking about today is called Please Murder Me from 1956. This stars Angela Lansbury and Raymond Burr, two fantastic actors who, you know, the name you should recognize from something, you know, whether it be, Bedknobs and Broomsticks for Angela Lansbury, Murder, She Wrote, and then, of course, Raymond Burr is Perry Mason.
Yes.
And in fact, in this film, he plays a lawyer. As it turns out, this was done 1 year prior to his role of Perry Mason. So you kind of get the impression this was his audition reel.
Yeah, and I got to say, in that way alone, it is a fascinating film to watch. If for no other reason, he's very commanding in this film. And you could really see, as you said, not only does it seem like an audition reel, but you really do see like, if any actor conveyed intensity with his eyes and his eyebrows alone, it's this man.
Yeah, he always carries himself. If he's not a big man in real life, or if he wasn't, I should say, he certainly carries himself as if he were. He literally looks like a brick wall walking through a room sometimes.
Oh, no joke. And his, at times, his head looks smaller than the rest of his frame. He's got such an imposing figure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's get into a little bit of
now,
the,
I gotta ask.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, I apologize. I was going to ask, did you notice that he did this film the same year as Godzilla?
I didn't think about that. That is true.
Isn't that crazy? The same year that he played American reporter Steve Martin, no, not that Steve Martin, in Godzilla, King of the Monsters, the American version of the Japanese film, he did this film back to back.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. I had not thought about that. That is a real, there is no similarities between these two.
there's no connection of going from film noir to Godzilla, King of the Monsters. Absolutely not. It's really bizarre. But he looks exactly the same, and apparently he did the films back to back. And of course, Godzilla is the movie that has lasted and is probably one of his most well, if not his very most well-known role, other than Perry Mason. Whereas this film, despite the fact that it's him and Angela Lansbury, I've never heard of this film before.
Yeah, and that's what surprises me, and that's one of the things that surprised me a lot about some of the public domain films. And I explained to Lydia in the very first episode that what I really liked and why I called the podcast Orphaned Entertainment is because in today's world of lawyers, rather fittingly, and litigation and rights, I mean, anyone that wanted to reclaim or get the rights to a lot of these films, they could, or keep the rights, they could have found a way. And something like this that just gets, well, you know, the copyright expired, let's just let it lie. It baffles me.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when this actually has star power, because, you know, as you know, so many films in public domain that you've never heard of the title, you've never heard of the actors, and it's these movies that are just waiting to be discovered. But in this case, if it's something like this or Night of the Living Dead, you wonder why someone, you know, make the effort to get this thing. You know, one of the most famous movies that was in public domain for a long time until Ted Turner wised up and finally bought it was It's a Wonderful Life. They used to show that thing for free on television for years until Ted Turner said, no, that's a perennial holiday classic. I'm going to buy it. I'm going to put it on my network, and it'll be a very special event that it gets shown every year. And, you know, he's making a fortune off that movie that used to be shown on TV for years. It's like, why, for Pete's sake, still show Raymond Burr and Angela Lansbury TV shows and TV movies all the time. Well, why didn't somebody snatch this thing up?
Yeah, I mean, easily you could at least throw it in. Well, and it may be, but one of the things the public domain, a lot of the public domain films, is you'll see the DVD box sets. You'll see, you know, maybe you might see a Raymond Burr classic box set or something, and something like this may show up on it because, hey, no one owns it. I can do whatever I want. Here it is. And
right.
But and in some cases, I think some studios try to claim ownership by doing that. But, you know, I don't consider, if throwing a little bug at the bottom of the screen and not doing anything to the film, you're not cleaning it, you're not remastering it, that's not ownership to me. So, sorry.
I completely agree. It's really frustrating. There's a film I've shown a few times to my film students a couple of years ago, actually. I've showed this film called The Legend of Boggy Creek. You may have heard of this film.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Legend of Boggy Creek was, I mean, the short version of it is that it was kind of the Blair Witch of its day. It was the first documentary-style faux horror movie, excuse me. It takes place in the woods, and it's kind of this kind of poor, lower middle class family, and they encounter this monster that keeps kind of stalking and harassing them. And a lot of it's first person, a lot of, you know, it's a lot of Blair Witch kind of stuff. But of course, this is the early 70s, so it's really cheesy. You see, you know, glimpses of a guy in a bear suit. But this film was a drive-in smash. It was one of the top grossing films of its year. It was hugely successful. There have been Boggy Creek sequels. But the original Legend of Boggy Creek, it's public domain. You could watch it on YouTube right now. You could buy it on DVD for like $3. And as you mentioned, it's one of these things where whoever has purchased it in order to distribute it has not cleaned it up. I mean, it's a movie of 73, and it's ugly, it's grainy, and it deserves, you know, it's not one of the great horror films, but for Pete's sake, it deserves better treatment than, you know, kind of the garage sale treatment it's had.
Yeah, absolutely. That's if it is public domain, I'll have to check that one out for sure, and maybe it'll find its way to a future episode here.
Yeah, no, it's a great film. I mean, I can't say it's one of the scariest movies ever made, quite the opposite, actually, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, excellent. We have not done a real, like, horror, quote-unquote horror film. We've done one that I think tried to be, but...
yeah, there's a lot of those out there.
Yes. Well, if you don't mind, let's get into a little bit of the plot of Please Murder Me, because it is worth discussing. The film opens with a man walking through the streets of a large city and eventually finding his way to a pawn shop where he purchases a handgun, which is kind of interesting in today's world. Just, I love the display of handguns along with all kinds of little tchotchkes, musical instruments, whatever, all sitting there together.
Yeah, definitely a very different time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, during the taxi ride home, we get some literally explosive credits. I really love the way the credits were done. As he's loading each chamber with the bullet, as the bullet smacks into the chamber, literally a credit explodes out onto the screen. I really like that. That was fun. It's the little things.
Not subtle. Nothing subtle about this movie.
No, absolutely not. We still haven't seen his face. He's just been this dark figure on the street, a dark figure in his office. He sits down at his desk, and he begins recording a message. And in this message, he announces that in 55 minutes, he'll be murdered. And at that point is where the first time you see his face, he comes out of the shadow. I thought that was a really neat kind of, just a really neat little scene.
Yeah, it's a real interesting reveal because they treat him like he's a big movie star. You know, because today this would be the kind of reveal we get if the star was Brad Pitt or George Clooney, that they really take their time to reveal who they're watching. Or even like the Indiana Jones movies, you know, how the camera really takes its time to reveal that you're looking at Harrison Ford. They're really playing it up, not only the fact that you're about to see Raymond Burr, but also the concept. It's such a high concept gimmick for a movie like this. It's very much like the movie DOA. The original O'Brien version of DOA, which I believe came out the year before, where I believe in the first scene, a man walks into a police station. They go, what are you here for? And the man goes, I want to report a murder. And the cops go, who? And he goes, my own murder. And that's how the movie starts. So, again, very very similar format of high concept film noir.
Yeah, very cool. Well, this message is to Ray Willis, who's a district attorney. We don't find out exactly why yet, but it comes into play later. Craig starts to tell a little backstory about his friend Joe Leeds, and this story goes all the way back to World War II. And I'll admit, when he first starts telling this story and that it was going back to World War II, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, how long is this movie?
Yeah, I was expecting a full-on like battlefield flashback myself, yeah.
Yeah. Well, turns out Craig and Joe were like brothers. They spent some time together in the war. They each kind of had each other's backs and saved each other's lives a couple times. And we finally get the wavy flashback to a day about 6 months earlier. Barry, I want to ask you, do you have any idea when did the wavy flashback enter into filmdom?
I'll guess and say it might have been something Orson Welles came up with. It feels like something he might have created, because it is such a there's something so beautifully gimmicky and richly cinematic about it. I will look that up. If I'm on your next podcast or in a future podcast, I will have the answer by then, because that's a great question.
Oh, okay, fantastic. I have to think, because I keep going back further and further in films, and it's still there. So it's like this thing that's always been there. Well, this flashback takes us to, like I said, 6 months earlier, where Craig confronts his friend Joe about an affair that he has been having with his wife, Myra. This was a pretty decent scene. It was just, Perry Mason really holds himself well as this man who, you can tell, he has got something to say. He is not comfortable saying this. This is a conversation that would be incredibly hard for somebody, and you completely buy it with Burr's performance here.
Yeah, and I got to say, his friend, who, as you mentioned, this is a friend he grew up with and has known his whole life, he takes this horrible news pretty well.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, how he opens up the conversation.
Are you happy being married to Myra? And Joe, don't tell me it's none of my business. Well, I don't know. Happy is a word that means a lot of things. It's a state of being. I never asked myself. I got a beautiful wife, a lovely home, good business. I can't expect anything. I guess being grateful is as good as being happy.
Like I say, you kind of know right away that something's not quite right here. But yeah, after he finally, or after what's his name, Craig finally admits what's happening and that he wants to marry Myra, Joe's response: "Are you sure? Are you sure you know what you're doing?" Not are you mad or how could you do this?
And you probably noticed that really great film noir touch where Burr says something to the effect of I'm in love with your wife, and you hear the soundtrack go dun dun dun.
just putting that little emphasis on there a little bit more.
Right. Just in case we missed how shocking that revelation is, yes.
Exactly. Well, Joe, like you said, takes everything really, really calmly. says it's kind of taking the wind out of him. He needs a couple days to think about it, and leaves Craig. Craig then goes to see Myra, and again, talk about everyone taking things pretty calmly. You know, she does the, oh, hi, dear. Did you have a tough day at court? You know, how was your day? And he's like, well, I saw Joe. I told him about us. Oh? What did he say? Just not as much reaction as you'd think.
Yes, and this is, of course, is Angela Lansbury, young, beautiful Angela Lansbury. She has two men fighting over her, and she doesn't seem all that excited about that.
No, not at all. I think what I wonder, though, too, is this just us being so used to the modern melodrama? I mean, if this movie was made today, if someone, I'm having an affair with your wife, there would be fights, there would be anger and yelling, and I told Joe about us today. What? You told, what? You know, and we don't have this. Is this just our 21st century, expectations?
Good question. I think the answer is yes and no. On the one hand, this is a more innocent time, and yes and no. Because yes, on the one hand, we expect them to be so much more demonstrative in their attitudes and reactions. But on the other hand, this movie came out 12 years after Double Indemnity. Not to mention so many other thrillers like it, dealing with infidelity, or a couple coming up with some plan in which they have to kill one person in order to earn some money and run off together. There have been so many other films like this that there is such a tameness and a quaintness to Please Murder Me that is, it's kind of surprising. It's refreshing, and it's also kind of surprising that the movie isn't more melodramatic, that it isn't even more violent or sexy. There's something very even-keeled about everything, the performances, even the violence. for a movie that is about, you know, basically a love triangle, there's no sexual heat or tension. And I mean, you know, of course, well, we need to get through the plots, and but we'll get back to that. But I think one of the things about the movie that's both kind of a plus and a minus is that it's the kind of film noir you probably could watch with your grandmother. it's both a recommendation and a negative. I mean, it's, you know, this is you won't confuse this movie with Hitchcock, but at the same time, it's, you know, I think during this time, I mean, Alfred Hitchcock Presents was already on TV, and that show had a lot more, even I would say, more erotic heat when it came to these sort of stories. And I think and jumping to some of the analysis of the film, but I think that there's something kind of missing in terms of the immediacy of the characters for a movie that's a film noir, and you know, and it ends up being, of course, about double crosses and triple crosses, not to mention the gimmick of you know, I'm going to get someone to murder me because I asked them to. I feel like there's kind of a lack of tension throughout this film.
Yeah. Okay. Very much. And we'll get it back into some more of these themes as we go through the plot.
Yeah.
Well, from this point, we see Joe, who is still mulling things over, meeting with a friend of his, Lou, at his office. And Joe's apparently been thinking a lot, and he's made a decision that, as he puts it, may affect him and Myra's whole life. He asked his friend Joe to mail a letter before calling Myra to let her know that he's on his way home. Joe gets home and finds Myra in the bedroom. He throws the cat out of the room, shuts the door, and a few moments later, we hear a gunshot.
There is a quaintness to this film. I use the word quaintness. There's a quaintness to the violence in this movie that certainly begins with the murder scene, which is kind of left to the imagination of the audience. It's kind of like how it would unfold on a radio show as opposed to in a movie that would be playing in theaters.
You don't know what happened. It isn't like a Columbo where you see the murder and then it's just a matter of waiting for the truth to come out for the people on the screen. Nobody knows. The audience doesn't know anything more until the characters themselves find out about it.
Yeah.
Well, Joe at this point is dead, and Myra tells the police that it was self-defense, that he attacked her. Craig is there as the police investigate. And Lieutenant Bradley, the investigating officer, is none other than Denver Pyle. Did you notice that?
Yeah, Denver Pyle. I was so taken aback by this, and I thought, no, that can't be him. And sure enough, the end credits also starring Denver Pyle. Yeah, who would have thought?
Yeah, I didn't recognize him. I don't think I recognized him in the bedroom at the time when he was doing the investigating, but it was later on, when we'll get there in the court scene, as he's sitting at the witness chair, I'm looking at him like, oh yeah, that's definitely him. You can just imagine the white beard on him and like, I'll be damned, that's Uncle Jesse.
Exactly.
Well, the cops arrest Myra on suspicion of murder. They don't really buy all her story. There's a really great scene at this point with the reporters running into the press room. And I thought this was a really neat way to tell a lot of story in a short amount of time. They essentially get the entire opening arguments out of the way in this, what, maybe 30, 40 second scene of the reporters all rushing to the phone and filling in their editors about what's going on.
Yeah, those kinds of scenes. There's a lot of those scenes in Preston Sturges movies and His Gal Friday, these movies where, you know, these kind of tough-talking, fedora-wearing, trench-coat-wearing reporters typing furiously, talking madly into the phone. It's always a kind of a fun staple of these older films.
Yeah. And there's also a little bit, I like there was a real quick little bit of physical comedy. One of the only scenes of physical comedy in this film is when the one reporter runs by, it turns out that it's the news photographer is just sitting on the phone. He's got his feet up across the aisle on a table. And as the reporter runs through, he just pushes his legs, and the guy just swivels in his chair and just moves his legs to the other desk without missing a beat. For some reason, it stuck out on me. I thought it was really funny.
Yeah, a little nice moment to ease the tension a bit.
Yeah, exactly. And that's about the only bit of tension easing that you're going to get in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. There's no other moments of comic relief. You're absolutely right.
Well, then we get to the courtroom and we finally actually meet the district attorney, Ray Willis. And this is where I say it becomes Raymond Burr's audition reel for Perry Mason. I don't have all the notes of the courtroom written down, because it is essentially the typical courtroom scenes with the questioning and the back and forth, unless there was anything really that you saw that you wanted to talk about or mention.
I guess the only thing that probably deserves mention is that at one point he reveals that he loves Myra, if I remember correctly. He reveals that he's the attraction to her, and he still wins the case. I was very surprised by that.
Yes, I was going to say, the courtroom scene is pretty much a courtroom scene up until the closing arguments, and yeah. That's what he uses. He admits his affair with Myra is a way to justify her actions. I guess the argument from the DA was, you know, why would he suddenly turn violent? Why would she have any reason for doing any of this? And, you know, or why would he have any reason for doing this? And that's when he admits to having the affair. And again, very calmly, the jury shows absolutely no reaction when he says this.
Yeah.
The courtroom, the audience all does the murmur and, and the judge has to bang his gavel, but the jury themselves, very calm.
I think it's probably the most far-fetched moment in the film by far.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was really expecting more from that jury. Didn't get it. And yes, with another flurry of reporters in the press room, we find out that she is not guilty. Apparently that does it, that sways it. And it was a pretty good argument back and forth. So you really, it could have gone either way. So that was kind of an interesting little bit. And, you know, it needed something, and he pulled it out. Well, at what I took to be a kind of a celebration for her acquittal, Lou stops by to talk to Craig. Turns out he forgot to mail that letter. I hope I mentioned it. Did I mention the letter Joe was asked Lou to mail?
You know, it's okay. I don't think they mentioned the letter either. So.
Well, they did. It was a real small scene. He just asked, like, you mind mailing this on your way out? And Lou says, sure. Stucks it into his coat pocket and leaves. So shows up at the house. And he still has the letter. He put it in his tuxedo pocket and forgot all about it until he got in his tux to come to the party. And it turns out it was addressed to Craig. Well, in this letter from Joe, he tells Craig about a whole other side of Myra and that he actually offered her a divorce, but she wanted half his business. And she admitted to him that she never loved him. She's never loved Joe, and he thinks she's never loved Craig. What her true love is was some artist fellow named Carl, and calls her, she's a disease. She's already destroyed me. I don't want her destroying you. So Joe didn't go to kill Myra. He went to finally kind of give her a last chance. I'll give you the divorce with nothing, was pretty much what he was going to do. But Myra knew that the only way she was going to get anything out of him was to kill him. So it turns out Myra indeed killed Joe.
Dun, dun, dun.
So Craig goes to meet Carl, which I thought was kind of cool. And Carl has no idea about Craig and Myra. I don't think he had, it turns out he didn't know anything. He thought the affair that Craig admitted to was just a story to sway the jury. And then Carl, in fact, is a pretty nice guy.
Very nice. The starving artist, completely oblivious, has no idea.
Absolutely. Craig confronts Myra and tells, you know, that the gig's up, and he actually he pulls the letter out and starts reading, and I thought, are we really going to hear this all again? But they do the nice fade, and comes
That's
back.
Right.
It comes back to where he finishes the letter, and Myra planned everything. Like I said, she wanted, the only way she was going to get any Joe's money is if she was dead. And the only way that she would be able to get away with it is if he supported her in court and did the case. So, yeah, very well orchestrated plan by Myra. Definitely left a lot to chance, but it all worked out for her. At least it seemed to.
Yes.
I did think it was interesting that at one point, Craig actually hands her the damning letter to show her that Joe indeed wrote it. It's his handwriting. And she looks at it, she takes it in her hands and looks at it, and then hands it back to him. Like, wow, wouldn't that have been a good time to tear, you know, find a fireplace, anything?
Or just to stuff it in her mouth and swallow it, yes.
Yeah, something. Well, Craig tells Myra that she will She's going to pay for what she's done. And no, she can't be tried for the murder of Joe again. She's been acquitted. But she is going to commit another murder. She is going to kill him. And again, dun-dun-dun!
Yes. In fact, I think lightning strikes upon that plot revelation.
Probably. So Craig begins his plot to drive Myra to murder, and starting by getting to know Carl. So Craig has a portrait done by Carl, which actually looks really good. Carl's a very good starving artist, apparently. Well, Craig invites Carl and Myra out to dinner for a surprise. Of course, driving. I love the scenes with any scenes with Carl and Myra, and then when Craig shows up, he comes to the apartment. They're going to dinner. Angela Lansbury is just bristling. There is just absolute hatred emanating from this woman, as well as terror. At any moment, she's thinking that Craig is going to say something or do something that's going to tip Carl off or something, and she is just a bundle of nerves the whole time. Again, you can't not get better actors for something like this. Angela Lansbury does an amazing job.
As you may have noticed, Angela Lansbury nails her American accent in this film.
I did not know she was not American, actually.
Yeah, it's very light, and towards the end there are moments where it slips, but otherwise she's playing an American. Quite convincing.
Yeah, very much. I honestly, I don't know if I ever knew that she was. Is she British? I guess maybe I should have known. Now that I think back to some of her other roles, and I think, oh wait, she does have an accent, but it never occurred to me.
Yeah, in fact, I think this is the only time I've ever seen her without her British accent. And then I'm trying to remember, my favorite movie that she's done was The Manchurian Candidate. She was up for an Oscar for that film, and I don't recall if she had an accent in that film. But anyway, I've never seen her play a character so young and have a Yankee accent, which she does in this film, and I thought it was very good.
Yeah, very, very good. Fooled me. There you go. Well, again, so Craig and Carl and Meyer are at dinner. Craig has a big surprise. He passes a note over to Carl, and he's doubled Carl's payment for the portrait.
By the way, Carl, there's something I've been wanting to ask you. Suppose the portrait of me had turned out badly. Suppose you'd realized you'd made a mistake in the manner in which you'd handled it. What would you have done?
Destroyed it, of course.
Despite your fee?
Despite anything.
Strange. I've always felt that the same parallel existed in law. Well, I've got to be going. Good night.
Night, Craig.
I love it with Myra, Angela Lansbury right there. Like I said, again, just bristling. I loved it.
It's a nice moment. It is. It's one of the best lines in the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, later on, I think Myra shows up at Craig's house, and Craig tells Myra that he has compiled proof about Myra.
At first, I thought Carl Holt was like you. But it wasn't long before I changed my mind. You fooled him, Myra, just like you fooled me. He's too fine to be hurt by someone like you. I'm not going to let it happen.
No matter what you tell him, he won't believe you. There's no way of proving that I killed Joe. You're just trying to frighten me with more threats.
Understand me, Myra. I never once meant to threaten you. I made you a promise. What I've compiled in this folder is no longer theory, it's proof. The only way you can prevent me from turning it over to Carl is to kill me.
I'm not going to kill you. I'm not going to kill you.
It must be maddening to know that in just a little while you're going to lose everything you've planned and killed for. You see, Myra, you can't win anymore.
So back to the present. The flashback is over. Craig is in his office still recording. And he's arranged for Meyer to meet him at his office. She arrives, and he lays the gun on the desk for Myra. Then he says, I'm going to go call Carl. I'm going to tell him everything. And the only way to stop me is with this, patting the gun. He goes to dial the phone, and sure enough, she picks up the phone, and after calling his name a few times, asking, begging him to stop, she does fire, kills him, and she rips open the file of the papers that he supposedly compiled, finds out that the quote-unquote evidence is nothing but stacks of blank paper.
Right.
Well, Ray Willis shows up, as apparently previously arranged, to show up about 10 minutes after Myra showed up. And, of right. course, Myra tells him, Craig shot himself. Ray checks it out, but as he's calling the police, he spots the microphone still laying on the desk, and he opens the drawer to find the tape machine still recording. Rewinding the tape, he plays it back. Craig's voice to his letter to Ray telling exactly what happened, and the scene ends with the tape playing and with a shot of Myra just crying in the side, knowing that everything's up. Her life is completely crumbling down around her. The end.
The end. Yep.
Yeah, this was a movie that, you know, a plot like this would only work in a movie. there was so much that could have gone wrong with any of these plans.
Yeah, I got to say, Raymond Burr's plan to have his friend show up 10 minutes after the murder was pretty, I mean, you know, he was counting on a lot of things to work in his favor, like the public transportation system, that his friend is very punctual. There's so many things that could have gone wrong with that, but that was so pivotal that he shows up at exactly the right time, finds a tape recorder, and manages to put two and two together and you know, discover Myra's deception.
Right, and finds her in the office. You're right. I mean, if he had been just like 5 minutes late, she would have already been out the door.
Right, right, exactly.
And then it would just be this tape, but no real evidence to support it. But even Myra's plan, you know, like, if I get him to fall in love with me, he'll defend me in court and win. I'm like, well, or not. And you spend the rest of your life, if not, you know, risk your life in the electric chair. But, you know, a good plan.
Yeah, definitely a movie, no question.
But still, it was a fun movie. I enjoyed it. I mean, this was our second foray into the film noir. The first one we tried was Shock with Vincent Price. And Lydia and I...
Oh, nice.
Yeah, but Lydia and I didn't... it didn't really grab us very well. A little bit, maybe, because we actually listened to a radio play based on the film the month prior. And so we kind of had the baggies of the radio play going into the movie, so we kind of, you know, we knew what was going to happen, and maybe that kind of tainted it a little bit for us.
Okay.
So, yeah, we wanted to kind of get into the genre one more time before we just, you know, moved on. And, of course, we'll come back to it again. There are tons of films like this just laying loose out there in the interwebs. So we'll definitely come back. But it was interesting. It was neat to see such big actors in some of their, you know, earlier roles.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll say one of the, you know, you mentioned about how the effect of Shock, the Vincent Price movie, kind of was kind of muted because of expectations and also your prior experience to it. And I had a similar thing with Please Murder Me. The first thing I ever encountered for this movie upon your telling me we were going to discuss it was the poster. And I should know better than to let a movie poster tagline suck me in. But I quote, the movie poster's tagline was, "The strangest request you have ever heard makes the most thrilling picture you have ever seen."
Okay.
So needless to say, I was expecting a little more. Just a little bit. And of course, this came out in 1956, and it feels much older to me. As I mentioned, not only are the violence and the sexuality and even the tension of the story, although there is tension, everything felt very muted, as though it were kind of more fit for TV than a motion picture. And I guess it wouldn't be any surprise that I discovered the director, Peter Godfrey, is primarily a television director. His most famous movie is Christmas in Connecticut with Barbara Stanwyck. So clearly dark thrillers are really not his forte. He's mostly a TV guy. Also, this being 1956, the film, although it has this really great cast, it's clearly a B film. It's clearly the kind of movie that played the second half of the drive-in double feature, King and I, The Ten Commandments. Those are the top films of 1956. So I think for a film that was, you know, made not only in the era of color, but after some 12 years after Double Indemnity. I think I was expecting more for a movie that was, you know, a love triangle, a movie about, you know, human deception and sexual duplicity. I did enjoy the film, and I liked the film. And I think Raymond Burr in particular was very commanding in his role. But for me, it felt like something that would have been more appropriate for television.
Yeah, I think I'd kind of have to agree. And maybe that's a little bit too, because like I said, so much of it just reminds you of watching a Perry Mason. I mean, I look at Raymond Burr. I mean, he does this film and literally the next year he becomes Perry Mason. And what do you know Raymond Burr from after Perry Mason? Very little. It's just, it really colors, I think. And then, of course, Angela Lansbury does a lot of roles. Manchurian Candidate, you mentioned earlier. But then her TV, most people think of Murder, She Wrote. So you end up looking at these actors as two TV actors. And right. Then in a film that is, like you said, just very kind of muted and toned down. And I really expected it to be a little, certainly the tone, the themes were dark themes, but the tone of the film wasn't as dark as I thought it would be.
Not that the film is light necessarily, but no, you're right. There is a lack of a heaviness there. And as we mentioned early in the movie, when the big plot revelations unfold, the actors and or the characters seem to take everything really well for a movie, you know, that presents some really dramatic plot twists, some real, I would even say, really shocking twists. And everybody seems to take everything quite well.
Yeah, very much. If it weren't for the music that would kind of swell at those moments or do the thunderclaps or whatever, it would almost be, oh, wait, is that a surprise? Was that a shock? Am I supposed to react?
yeah, no kidding.
You, the audience, actually find yourself, is that important?
Right. Yeah, it's film noir, and those moments definitely helped. I appreciated the thunderclaps and the very melodramatic moments. And you mentioned the beginning. I want to say again, I love the opening of this film. I love that it's a character strolling down a dark alleyway and a dark street illuminated by neon signs. That is classic, classic film noir. And one of the strongest moments of the film is in the climax, where Raymond Burr is looking directly into the camera, and there's a bit of light shining on his eyes, which not only illuminate how intense he is, but in how intense the scene is as he's talking to Lansbury behind him, and you kind of see how the inner workings of his mind are coming out. There's some really nice moments like that in this film. For a film that isn't particularly cinematic, and I mean that respectfully, it's well made, but for a film that really could be a TV movie, it does have some really, really rich moments.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think it'd be worth checking out if you're interested in the film noir, certainly if you're a fan of either of the main characters, or if you're a fan of Denver Pyle and just want to see a really young, dark-haired Denver Pyle.
Who isn't a fan of Denver Pyle? Come on.
Exactly. Who?
Denver Pyle fans out there. And I guess the last thing I wanted to throw out there was I had to look it up. I was so curious if this was the case, and indeed it is. This is the first and only time Angela Lansbury and Raymond Burr ever worked together, which I find amazing. Raymond Burr passed away 20 years ago, but I mean, his television, even his film credits are remarkable. I mean, 2 years prior to Please Murder Me, he was in Hitchcock's Rear Window. I mean, this is a guy he's worked with Alfred Hitchcock. He's worked with Godzilla. This guy's worked with everybody. And then you get to Lansbury, who is still acting, which is astonishing. She's 88 years old. She's still acting. In fact, she was in that remake of Mr. Popper's Penguins. Yeah, she was in the Jim Carrey film. Yeah, just 2 years ago. I mean, she's still acting. She doesn't just do voice work. But one thing I looked up was she has played Jessica Fletcher, her Murder, She Wrote character, on Magnum P.I. But other than that, she was never on Perry Mason, and Raymond Burr was never on Murder, She Wrote, which is so strange because Murder, She Wrote always had a revolving door of celebrity guest stars, but never Raymond Burr. They never acted together in anything other than this film.
That's amazing, especially with Murder, She Wrote. That just seems like an obvious opening for someone like Raymond Burr to step in and even, you know, reprise the Perry Mason character, or just some other lawyer. Maybe he could be, you know, Jerry Mason or
right. Exactly. I mean,
if there was a rights issue, he could have just been some other lawyer. But yeah, why didn't they get back together?
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, Murder, She Wrote was like the Love Boat with the body count. I mean, it was just every celebrity you can think of has been on that show. Robert Englund, a.k.a. Kruger, was on that show. I mean, everybody was on Murder, She Wrote, but never Raymond Burr.
Unbelievable. Yeah, they do fantastic together in this film. Now, I don't know where you watched your version, but the version that I watched came off archive.org, and I have to admit, it looks pretty rough and sounds pretty rough, too. There's several audio issues. Sometimes the sound just sort of drops out. Really hard to hear some of the dialogue. Lots of film scratch. So did you have any better luck with your copy?
Slightly. I mean, but I had the same experience you did. On the one hand, it was on YouTube, and I think they did a fine job of doing the best they can. It was illuminated enough that the dark scenes, I could actually see what was going on in the darkness, which was nice. But as you mentioned, there were moments where film scratches started to come down where I wasn't sure if it was raining in someone's office at times because yeah. The scratches were so prominent. I thought, is this like a cheap 1956 special effect? But no, for the most part, it was watchable, but I agree with you. I mean, this movie needs to be cleaned up. The sound needs to be cleaned up. It's you know, for a film that's actually, you know, and I'm a little harder on it than you are, but for a film that really isn't bad and has two major stars, the only time they ever work together, and it's a completely workable film noir, this movie deserves a lot more respect than just than the very subpar version that's currently out there.
Yes, and definitely more respect than Orphan Entertainment, right?
No question. It has been orphaned. It has been abandoned. Someone needs to adopt this movie. No question.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for us today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you continue to download future installments. If you'd like to get in touch with us with any suggestions, comments, or general feedback, you can join us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/orphanedentertainment. You can leave a short voicemail using the SpeakPipe app on our homepage, or you can drop us an email at orphanedent@johnja.net. All the links and info will be in the show notes. I once again want to thank my co-host. Thanks, Barry.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I hope you'll not be a stranger to Orphan Entertainment.
Oh, I will return.
All right. And of course, special thanks to our listeners. Goodbye until next time.